KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
You're tuned in to KAEB, 91.9 on your FM dials, playing you the hits from yesteryear, this year, and the next.
Fish enthusiasts out there, whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. It's Monday, February 24th, 2025, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Liebrich with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and my co-host, Luke Gaiero.
And this week, we're going to be talking about the southernmost sturgeon you have ever done seen. We're talking about Atapensa oxyrhynchus desotii, the Gulf sturgeon.
Love it. All right.
Okay.
And I am super happy to welcome our guests. Adam Kaiser is a fish biologist at our Panama City Fish and Wildlife Conservation Office. And Frank Peruca is a retired lifetime fisheries biologist and distinguished Gulf sturgeon researcher. So it sounds like we have a lot of knowledge about Gulf sturgeon sitting here in this virtual room, and we're super pleased to have you both on the show.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thanks. I'm
very excited to be here.
Okay, to set the stage for folks listening, we like to start out with a basic introduction of our Fish of the Week. Can both of you just kind of help us get a picture in our minds about what this fish looks like and maybe what it also feels like to touch?
First of all, the Gulf sturgeon looks unlike any other fish you've probably ever seen. And if one happens to wash up on the beach and you're walking along and find one, a lot of people are just confused and surprised to encounter it. This is a fish that has its roots that go back millions of years, relatively unchanged over that time, and possess some very unique characteristics. For example, the outside of the body is covered in five rows of bony scutes, which are these plates. Some are leaf-like in shape, some are sort of triangular in shape. Those offer protection for the inside of the fish, which is relatively boneless. The skeleton is cartilaginous. And in between those scutes, there's a lot of hard, smaller scales that will scratch the heck out of you when you're handling them. So PPE, protective equipment for handling sturgeons, gloves, long sleeves. Otherwise, you end up with what we call sturgeon rash. It's like someone taking sandpaper to your arms if you handle these all day long. The scutes on the small fish are extremely sharp. They're like razor blade sharp, which I imagine would not be too nice if you tried to swallow one, if you were trying to prey on a young sturgeon. Over time, they wear down and they get kind of smoothed down by the elements, and they're not quite as sharp.
They've got barbels, very similar to catfish, and they have a tubular mouth that is underneath the head, which projects out just like a vacuum cleaner.
Yeah, no teeth. It's like a fleshy, blubbery, tube-like mouth that they use to suck up their prey.
They're bottom feeders. They feed on mollusks. They'll feed on marine worms, amphipods, lancelots. What's interesting is the subadults and adults don't feed in the freshwater river systems. They basically fast. They'll lose weight. And then when they make their migration to the Gulf or the marine bays, that's when they do their feeding.
And how big are they? Fish that go to the ocean, it seems like they have the potential to get pretty big.
We've collected them up to 9 feet in length. 200 pounds is the largest we've collected. But on record, they've been documented up to 500 pounds. That was back in the 30s. And I saw one old report where there was a 14-foot sturgeon that hit a tug back in the early 1900s on the Pasco River. Now, this is all hearsay. 14 feet, that's a pretty large fish.
Yeah.
But anyway, 500 to 600 pounds is the estimate on that one.
Wow.
But we don't see a whole lot of fish over 100 pounds now.
Yeah, just a few that might be pushing 200 pounds, and it's very rare to encounter those. I think I encountered my first one last year. I say think because I no longer pull these big fish out of the water to get a weight on them. It's just not that important to cause stress on the fish just to get a weight. So it was absolutely the biggest one I'd seen. The largest one I ever weighed was 165 pounds. They're really impressive when you see them up close. A documentary film that Frank and I worked on and produced last year called Gentle Giant, The Mystery of the Gulf Sturgeon. It's on our Fish and Wildlife Service YouTube channel, in case you want to see what the Gulf Sturgeon looks like in the water.
I watched it. Very good. I would recommend. Very nice imagery.
Beautiful places. Yes.
So where all can you find these fish? Obviously, the name implies that they're around the Gulf. What rivers can you find these in? And then historically and in the modern day, how far up the river would these fish go? And then how far out to sea would they go?
The range on them is from, say, Tampa Bay along the Gulf Coast all the way to the Mississippi River. A number of the river systems do have sturgeon in them. You know, at one time, the early 1900s, there was over 400,000 pounds just taken out of the Florida area on the west coast.
And
right after that, the numbers just went to almost zero, which is very similar to a lot of the incidences on the east coast with Atlantic sturgeon.
Nowadays, there are 7 populations of Gulf sturgeon, but historically, there were 2 additional populations that were extirpated. And those populations can be found from the Suwannee River in the east, that's in Florida, all the way to the Pearl River system in the state of Louisiana. Depending on the life history stage and the time of year, you could find these fish anywhere from, I'd say, a couple hundred miles from the coast upriver, not quite into the headwaters of these river systems, but in the sort of middle reaches. For example, we're talking about the Apalachicola River. Prior to Jim Woodruff Dam closing access to the upper reaches, fish would have been found as far north as Albany, Georgia, maybe even Macon, Georgia, which is pretty far distance from the Gulf. Their life history has them migrating out into the Gulf during the winter to feed. And when they're out there, they will distribute east and west along the shoreline and stay within a kilometer or two of the shore, seeking their benthic food. They are highly migratory, roam very widely, and you could find them just about anywhere. And based on reports that we receive, that much is true. Last year, we got a report of a fish that turned up in a tributary to Tampa Bay. It had died there in the summertime. And we have a very small little tributary that perhaps was offering some thermal refuge. I can only imagine that that might be why the fish wandered up in there. But as far as population sizes go, the largest populations in the Suwannee River. So most people that know anything about Gulf sturgeon think about the Suwannee because it has somewhere between maybe 5 to 10 or 12,000 fish in the population. And they make themselves known during the summertime with their jumping behavior. And with that population having grown so much over the years, those fish are now being found in places like Tampa Bay where they historically occurred, but were seldom seen until recent times.
So you've mentioned a little bit, you know, their winter feeding behavior, this jumping. Can you kind of take us through a year in the life of one of these fish? And then more broadly, what is an entire lifetime like for these fish? How long do they live? Just what are they doing and why are they doing that?
Well, we'll start with spawning. And that typically with Gulf sturgeon occurs in the springtime. So they'll migrate out of the Gulf of Mexico, out of the bays, up into freshwater rivers, returning to their natal river to spawn almost always. And those spawning areas, they're seeking hard rocky substrates. And those substrates, 100 to 200 miles away from the coast, they're migrating to find these spawning areas. They release their eggs, which are sticky and adhesive, in these rocky areas. The eggs hatch and the embryos shelter in the crevices of the rocks themselves. And then within a few days of development, the larval sturgeon will then swim away from the spawning areas and begin feeding on their own. They'll spend the entire first year of their life, more or less, in the river environment. So those young of year sturgeon that are anywhere from a couple centimeters long to a few inches long, they're feeding in the river. They have to find invertebrate prey, like a midge larvae and other types of things that are either drifting or down in the bottom sediments.
Yeah.
They'll make their way down to the estuary and begin feeding in the low salinity portions of the estuary. After that, the cycle kind of repeats itself. After first year of life, that's when they begin fasting. And they're not really doing much feeding at all in the river during the summer because it's thought to be not energetically beneficial to them to be out seeking food where it's sparse. Instead, they're conserving energy and they'll wait until the winter and the temperatures drop to out-migrate to the bays, estuaries, and the nearshore Gulf where they can find a lot more food. And because they're a sturgeon and because they like cooler water, really, and they grow and they thrive best in cooler temperatures, that behavior that they exhibit in the summer where they're resting and conserving energy is pretty interesting. They don't do this everywhere. In fact, what happens with Gulf sturgeon is that there are just a handful of discrete areas in each of these freshwater river systems where the fish congregate, and they aggregate there in really large numbers. In some cases, like hundreds of sturgeon are present in one small reach, you know, maybe 500 to 1,000 meters in length. And they're sitting there kind of hovering near the bottom or resting on the bottom, conserving energy for the entire summer, which essentially down here lasts anywhere from 5 to 6 or even 7 months.
Long time to fast.
They're losing body mass during that time, and that's been documented. And when they go out to the Gulf, they really have to feed heavily to restore their energy reserves. And if they're female, they need that energy to produce their batch of eggs. You know, adult males and females need that energy to make that migration when it's finally time to spawn in the river. So that's kind of the life cycle.
Yeah. On the Apalachicola River, the river system with the dam there, we lost probably 80% of the potential habitat for these sturgeon to spawn. And when they do spawn, you're only getting less than 1% that actually make it.
Yeah.
It's really difficult because there's so much predation there with the minnows, the various benthic feeders will be picking up these eggs. Crayfish will take care of these eggs. Plus, the females, they don't spawn annually like a lot of the other fish do. It's probably every 3 to 5 years you'll get the females spawn, where the males will spawn annually.
How long do they live?
30 years is a pretty good age on them. They'll get up to probably 40, get some old fish, but that's about it.
Yeah, we started sturgeon research goes back almost 50 years. So the first time anyone went out and started tagging fish was almost 50 years ago. But yeah, they were using tags back then that we wouldn't even recognize or expect to find on a fish anymore. This is before pit tags. I know Frank and I have caught a few fish that were at least 30 years of age, but they might have been tagged when they were 100-pound fish. So you know that it took quite a few years to get to that point. You'd have to be pretty lucky if you're a Gulf sturgeon to make it to 30 years of age.
You've gone on the record as saying that the Gulf sturgeon is a fish that you can come to love, but that you just can't trust them.
You think you've got them down pat, and then you find something new about them, just like these summer resting areas, or, you know, like we thought that when they migrate out, that they would go fairly long distances in the Gulf, maybe in the deep Gulf. But we found that they basically stayed along the shore. They stayed in water that was maybe only 10 meters deep and seemed to occupy those areas. So there's always a little bit of a twist on these fish.
To that point, you mentioned the summer resting areas, their behavior in the Gulf. What are some of the discoveries about the Gulf sturgeon that you guys have found to be the most surprising?
Well, you know, we've done some population studies on these fish, and one was to capture, tag, and recapture. We would tag as many fish as we could during the summer. Then we would go ahead towards the river mouths and set nets out and collect the fish as they migrated down the river systems. This was done in the fall. We would be out there for basically a month in a houseboat. We would be fishing with 12-inch stretch, 5-inch stretch nets, 250 feet across, covering about 80% of the river. We'd go from sunup to well into the night. This process took about 70 volunteers during the whole year. On one particular study, we did not catch a fish for almost 10 days. And suddenly the river got a good rain, river came up, and we got like over 600 fish in less than a week. Things really started happening.
Yeah.
So, you know, they need a trigger to get moving. Temperature, rise in the water, it tells them, hey, it's time to get out and let's start feeding.
These studies are often done in pretty remote areas. You know, there's a lot of really open forested areas in North Florida. These rivers are quite beautiful. And one of the crazy things that happened to Frank one night while they were doing one of these surveys off the houseboat is some person swam up to their houseboat in the middle of the night.
Just had his underwear on. Yeah, that was really scary. Swam right through the nets.
Oh.
Said he was on the other side of the river looking for some deer hunting area and got lost and saw the lights on our boat, and he swam across, and we went ahead, gave him a blanket and took him to the boat ramp, which was about 2 miles away. And then we had to drive him to his car.
Yeah. Did you tag him?
It was several miles away. It was crazy. It was a crazy day.
Okay. Yeah, I bet you saw a lot of neat stuff. Adam, you mentioned sonar. Are these rivers pretty murky?
Most people will never get a chance to see a sturgeon because they're living in rivers that are turbid or muddy most of the year. Only during extreme droughts do you sometimes get a bit of water clarity. But even then, because sturgeon are mostly benthic, you still don't see them. One of the things that I've been working with for almost 20 years now is using low-cost side-scan sonar to survey and assess river habitat mostly. But it turns out that side-scan is really incredible at producing these really stunning images of the sturgeon underwater, especially the large fish. You know, once they're a meter or larger, they're really easy to pick out. And it's become quite popular to use side-scan sonar to survey reaches of river and then simply count the fish that are present. We've been doing this on an annual basis. We have what I call index reaches, which are areas that encompass the majority of these holding areas I mentioned earlier, where the fish are really aggregated. And we scan through there along a predetermined route, sometimes with multiple boats to get replicate passes. And then we mark the fish and count them up. And we're working to develop some automated tools, machine learning tools to automate the marking of the fish, which takes a little bit of time, but nothing like the hours, months, weeks, years it takes to tag fish the conventional or the traditional way and assess population size.
How can you tell a sturgeon on side scan sonar from, say, a large submerged log or a big gar or something like that?
Yeah, good question. I mean, it does take some training and some experience looking at different underwater features, but one thing that we do is we only try to mark and identify fish that are over a meter. So the Gulf sturgeon is pretty much the only fish in these systems that are reaching those sizes. And there are a couple characteristics that sometimes show up pretty well, like the rear set dorsal fin, the caudal fin. But it's really based on size and position in the channel itself that, you know, those characteristics are helping us to discriminate. This is a sturgeon, not something else.
Okay. You know, we worked with a number of commercial fishermen years back just to get a feel on where to go to net sturgeon. Back then, caviar was the big thing, and the Gulf sturgeon has probably body weight, maybe 10 to 15% of its body weight is caviar.
Oh, my gosh.
So you got a 100-pound fish, you've got 10, 15 pounds of caviar there, and you're looking at 300,000 to 400,000 eggs. One of the commercial fishermen that we worked with lived in Apalachicola, and they would take these skiffs and row up the river 12, 13 miles, just rowing up the river in the spring to net sturgeon. And they would spend a week up in these particular areas tying up the fish when they got one, and then they would come down and then they would process it for caviar. And on one occasion, this Greek fisherman, he mentioned that he went up the river and got up to his netting site and was seeing the sturgeon just jumping everywhere. He was going to make some money. He said he's never seen it like this. He was just about to set his nets, and he said the sky just turned blood red, scared him. It was Good Friday. He packed up his gear and went back downriver, never again to fish on Good Friday. Really a religious guy.
It's easy to develop some superstitions, though, when you're out there trying to catch these fish, especially when you're having a slow day.
What are some of yours?
There was one year that Frank and I were trying to catch fish for the BP oil spill injury assessment in the spring. So the fish are really scattered out, and we spent countless days on the water setting nets, not catching anything. And we had a few fish that were tied with acoustic transmitters. So we'd be listening for those fish and trying to, you know, set nets right in those areas where we had an acoustic tied fish. Well, there was this one fish, we knew the number on it, and we ended up coming to call this fish the shepherd, because every time we went and set a net where the shepherd was, he would draw all the other sturgeon away from us, and he would disappear off our radar, basically, and we wouldn't catch anything. And then there'd be other days where we found some fish on side scan, and we set the nets, and we would listen while the nets were soaking. And then the shepherd would come in and he would draw all the fish away from us again, and we wouldn't catch them. And we know this was happening because we could hear the fish and we could see them in side scan, you know, and we would be tooling around waiting for the nets to catch fish. But it's weird. They communicate. We know this is scientific fact that they communicate and they travel together. And I think the communication is what's important because they can't see each other when they're down there.
Yeah, what's their communication sound like?
They make these clicking sounds. They make clicking sounds that have been recorded. And they also, when they jump, they make these loud splashing sounds. And one of the strong hypotheses around jumping is that it's a secondary form of communication because they click before and after they jump. These are things that a retired scientist, Ken Sulak at USGS, determined in some of his work on the Suwannee River.
When we have set the nets in the fall, there's been occasions where we'll catch two sturgeon or three sturgeon in the net together, and then the following year, you'll catch the same two almost the same day. And even the following year, you'll catch the same two, like they're traveling together.
They're like, darn, we got caught again.
Right. It's like they're mating for life.
Not a lot of funding to pursue those research questions, but you know, they're interesting ones. But the jumping, and I need to credit Ken Sulak for this. We now know for sure, or about as sure as you can be in science, why they're jumping. And what Ken did was he put these special tags on some sturgeon in the Suwannee River called accelerometers. And this tag records the pitch, roll, tail beat frequency, and depth of the fish at 1 second intervals. I should back up for a second. Gulf sturgeon have this primitive air bladder. It's connected to the gut, okay? And the air bladder is what gives the fish its buoyancy underwater. The sturgeon want to be near the bottom or hovering at a specific depth when they're conserving energy. What happens prior to the jump is they appear to lose their buoyancy control, and they're up and down in the water column, which they don't want to be doing that. And then they jump, and when they're in midair, they take a big air, and then they plunge back down into the river and descend down to the bottom, and that forces the air down into the air bladder, and it restores the buoyancy. And you can see that pattern in the data that were coming from these accelerometer tags. They jump anywhere from once every 6 hours to every, I don't know, it depends on water temperature. The warmer the water, the more often they're jumping. And some of these places where they're congregating in the summer, these resting areas, I mentioned they have like hundreds of fish in one small place. The jumping can really be insane. And those are the dangerous places to be when you have a lot of jumping. So this is the largest freshwater fish in Florida across the Gulf Coast. And if you're in a boat and you happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time and get hit by one, it could create a lot of injury. Unfortunately, there was a young 5-year-old girl, 10 years ago, that died on the Suwannee River after a large sturgeon jumped on her.
And this is not malicious jumping, though. They need this to refill their air bladder.
Right, no, zero aggression. And you can't even, you know, make them jump if you wanted to. And when we're working with sturgeon, we're setting nets over these fish and we're working in these higher risk areas, but we've never been jumped on or anything like that. It's an extremely rare thing to happen. It's like a tree falling on you in the woods or something. But if you do spend time in these aggregation areas and you're motoring along quickly in a boat or a jet ski or something like that, that's when the accidents happen.
Are those areas well marked?
Warning signs up and down the river at the boat ramps. You got to be careful out there.
During the summer season, the state of Florida anyway has public service announcements and on the radio and on TV to caution boaters about the sturgeon jumping and say the sturgeon are back in the river. Be careful when you're out there. Those sorts of things.
Yeah, I had one fellow that he was on the river and he got hit in the chest by a jumping sturgeon, lost control of his boat and ended up in the woods. Somebody rescued him, and several years later, he came by the office, and he still had the shirt, which was all filthy from the sturgeon hitting him. He kept it as a souvenir.
Wow.
You know, wow.
Quite a souvenir.
Yeah.
Most of the time when they're jumping, they're at distance away from you, but I've had a couple jump really close, and I got to tell you, when it happens, it almost makes your heart skip a beat because you're not anticipating it. You can't see through the water, so you don't see it coming. And then all of a sudden, like at an arm's length away, here's a giant sturgeon that's eye level, like staring at you for just a second before it plunges back down in the water. And it even makes like a weird noise when it comes out of the water, like a, I don't know how to explain it. But all of a sudden, there's this gigantic sturgeon right next to you, you know, airborne.
I guess I'm kind of curious, too. There's other fish out there that are obligate air breathers or facultative air breathers that need air for some purpose, for respiration or something. Gars are an example, Arapaima. These fish can just come up to the surface and sip air and then go back down. So why is the sturgeon going to all this extra effort to clear the water completely instead of just coming up and breathing and going back down?
That's a good one. They will gulp air, as you're explaining. Like sometimes they'll just come up and take a little gulp. But more often than not, it is a very acrobatic launching themselves out of the water. And it's probably because it helps them to dive back down. They need to go back to depth where they came from to compress that air and get it back in their air bladder. And so by virtue of, you know, making this sky-high jump, I think it helps them to get back down to where they need to go.
I'm going to shift us just a little bit. We've talked about all the different kind of ways that these fish have been studied. I'm curious, what was the motivation in investing in those studies?
Well, a lot of it dealt with the caviar trade. Just the populations have been diminished to almost nothing. It was just the efforts of people along the Gulf Coast, researchers, universities, Federal Corps of Engineers, just said, hey, you know, we need to go ahead and take a look at this fish before it's gone.
Yeah.
And there's just so many things that are impacting the fish, various threats like dams, overfishing, channelization, sedimentation, that we felt that we needed to come up with a plan. The fish was listed as a threatened fish in 91, and then a recovery plan was developed in 1995, which kind of gave us a little bit of a direction on how to go ahead and recover the animal across the range here.
Yeah.
It was a cooperative effort between the folks along the Gulf Coast here.
Sounds like a huge undertaking to understand them.
You mentioned earlier in the show that the Suwannee River population is doing particularly well. I'm curious what about that river or that population has led to it being robust relative to the other populations.
This is like the $50 million question in sturgeon conservation, is what explains the pattern in abundance that we see east to west across the Gulf. There's at least a few good hypotheses. The Suwannee River, for one, is an undammed system. There's absolutely no barriers to spawning habitat. It has an abundance of rocky limestone origin spawning habitat available to the species. It's a fairly large river in terms of its channel dimensions. It's wide, it's deep, but it's low gradient. The fish has got a nice comfortable environment in the summer, which is made even more comfortable by the fact that there's several dozen springs that feed cold water into that river system year-round. It's the coldest river, if you want to call it that, across the range of the species. It has the coolest water temperatures in the summer. And you know, again, being a sturgeon and being in the southernmost area of the sturgeon's range here in this hemisphere, I think cold water is important in ways that we don't fully understand.
Speaking on that real quick, we mentioned at the top of the show that it is the southernmost sturgeon and that thermal tolerance is a limiting factor. Florida, the peninsula, goes way far south. And so presumably the waters down there are too warm for these sturgeon to exist for long. So how did the Gulf sturgeon actually end up where they are to become isolated from the sister subspecies?
Man, that's a good one. What I think happened in a past era is there was a feature called the Gulf Trough, which was at a time when sea levels were higher than they are today. And there was a water connection between the Atlantic coast and the Gulf that actually cut across the peninsula of Florida, if I'm not mistaken. And that might have been the time that Atlantic sturgeon colonized the Gulf. That was just a good story I'm making up.
Sounds reasonable. I mean, hey, it's an ancient lineage of fish, so it seems plausible to me. Although once you start talking hundreds of millions of years, I have a tough time conceptualizing that timeline.
Being closely related to Atlantic sturgeon, you know, a subspecies, there was a connection at some point in time in the past between Atlantic sturgeon and Gulf sturgeon. And I think that connection must have been made at a time when water levels were different than they are today.
Or maybe a couple fish went up the St. Mary's, through the Okefenokee, and down the Suwannee. I don't think that's likely.
I like that one.
So it sounds like some of the threats have gone away, you know, in terms of the caviar harvesting. What are some of the biggest threats still facing them today? And is there anything that the public can do?
Additional dams, like on the Pascagoula. That's one of the major rivers here that does not have a dam on it yet. And there's been a number of groups that want to put a dam on the Pascagoula, and a number of other little rivers here that do not have dams on them yet, but People are looking for, say, recreation or flood control. If these dams get in place, it's going to hamper sturgeon production.
Yeah. There's just an extensive list of things that could threaten Gulf sturgeon because of how wide they range and the various habitats they occupy. Some of these threats are actually of natural origin. Red tide is something that is known to kill sturgeon when they're out in areas that are experiencing red tide, and also major hurricanes. And we were able to complete a pretty thorough investigation of the impacts of Hurricane Michael, which came ashore in the fall of 2018 on the Apalachicola sturgeon population. And it actually caused mortality rate of 35 to 50% in that population. And those two naturally occurring phenomenon, red tide and hurricanes, are thought to be influenced by changes to the environment that are, of anthropogenic origin. So those are things we kind of keep an eye on. Then there's just the unknowns, right? Like, what are these environments going to look like 50, 100 years from now with the climate changing? And the Gulf sturgeon doesn't have a retreat in the sense that it cannot retreat northward, presently the way the Atlantic sturgeon can. It occupies the entire eastern seaboard. As temperatures warm, if retreat is necessary, what's going to happen to the Gulf sturgeon? We don't know.
Yeah.
What is it with the hurricanes exactly?
I mean, you get the high water coming out of the watersheds, pulling all the detritus out, and you certainly have low dissolved oxygen and the sturgeon, if they're in those areas, along with other fish, you do see the mortality.
And it just drops so quickly and they can't exit. Okay.
That's correct. It's in the Escambia River where Hurricane Ivan came in. This was in the fall, and the sturgeon are staging in the lower part of the river during that period. And there was a significant mortality on all kinds of fish. The following year, when we did a population study, you could see that the numbers of adults were significantly lower than they had been the previous population study. Now, the subadults and the juveniles, they were still up in the upper river. The adults were the ones that were really impacted because they were the first to leave. And so the hurricane really affected them.
So on the Apalachicola, we had something on between 30 and 40 adult fish tagged. And as Frank said, they were holding in the lower river when the storm hit. Well, roughly half of those fish made the decision to try to leave, and they did, and they left within 36 hours of the storm making landfall. And every fish that made that decision to leave survived and was subsequently detected returning to the river in the following year. But the other 50% that decided to stay, they all perished.
Wow.
Call it an adaptation or what you will, but they don't all do the same thing. And that behavioral variation is what preserved that population. Another really cool thing that happened is that we were able to document fall spawning in this population, which could have only occurred after the hurricane made landfall, and of course had to involve fish that remained in the river system and survived the storm. I mentioned the holding areas, and there's one holding area that's quite a ways upriver. It's actually much closer to the dam than it is anything else, and we think that the fish that occupy that holding area might be the ones that spawned in the fall that year. And that was an area that wasn't impacted by the storm.
It's fascinating.
And so the fall spawning, is that something that naturally happens for some segments of the population? Or was it like, oh, we had this aberrant event this year, this hurricane came through, something happened, so we didn't get the chance to spawn, and so we're just going to do it now because we've got these gametes and we got to get rid of them, and it's not ideal, but we're going to do it.
I'm glad you asked, because fall spawning is something that was only recently discovered in Gulf sturgeon. And by recent, I mean within the last 10 years or so. So for forever, the belief was that Gulf sturgeon were a spring spawner. But then we started to collect evidence in the Suwannee River, the Apalachicola, and Choctahatchee, which are the three easternmost populations, that there might be this fall spawning component or group of fish. And we now know that the fish that spawn in the fall in these three populations are as genetically distinct from the spring spawning group as they are adjacent populations. So it's almost like you have two populations in each of those rivers. That's how different they are.
It's kind of like your pink salmon up there, Katrina.
So you guys have really kind of dug into the species multiple years between the two of you working on it. What's the thing you're most proud of in your career?
Well, I think probably just working with the other researchers along the coast, getting them together where we're all working on the same page here. I feel that's been one of my important things that I've done over the years. I've had my granddaughter out netting sturgeon with me. She was 6 years old.
Oh, wow. Well, that was memorable for her.
She went out numerous times. She volunteered at the office several times. She worked on the Snake River for a while. And now she's going for her master's over at Auburn, working with paddlefish.
That's awesome.
I've had the chance to work with a number of different grad students over the 15 years I've been here. And I love doing that. We're wrapping up 5 years of research projects across the Gulf that involved a dozen or more graduate students. So being able to provide those opportunities and mentor these young professionals. As far as, you know, what I think is going to be the biggest contribution made in my career, I'm not sure I could even identify that at this point. Gulf sturgeon conservation in general is something that is going to take generations.
I am curious, Frank, you mentioned you're retired now officially, but still volunteering. You mentioned your granddaughter volunteering. What opportunities are there for people in the general public, whether they have a fisheries background or not, to maybe either actively work for the conservation of the species or to just promote it generally, promote an enthusiasm for it among their peers in the public?
We have people that just contact our office regularly. How can we help? There are a number of programs here at Ecological Services, plus our sturgeon work, and we do get volunteers all the time here.
I had a lady call me just out of the blue from my neighborhood who said that she had three grandkids that lived in Texas that were coming over there in the summer, and she was asking me, could I take them sturgeon fishing? And I said, sure. So I took these three boys out on the boat, and I taught them how to set a net and pull a net. First net we pulled, we caught an age one sturgeon and an adult side by side. I'm like, oh, cool. That doesn't happen.
That's perfect.
So you guys clearly care about this fish. Kudos for all your contributions towards understanding Gulf sturgeon. Do you have any insights for why other people should care? Why should we care about this fish? Why should the broader public care?
I'll tell you what, this fish is a survivor. Every person we have taken out, volunteers, other people that never have caught a sturgeon, they will go ahead and handle it. And it's almost like love at first sight. And they see that fish, they know it's been around, they look at it, they said, the knowledge is in this fish here. I can see it in its eyes. It's just a wonderful fish to work with. And it's certainly has been really abused, taken the caviar and the populations have dwindled, but yet it survives.
Okay. How about you, Adam?
I'd piggyback on that and just say that the Gulf sturgeon's ancestors made it through the ice age, you know, after the asteroid struck off the Yucatan Peninsula. And you know, if they can survive over that period of time, I'd hate to see it disappear off the face of the earth in just a couple hundred years because of our involvement, you know. So it's part of the natural history and legacy of this region. Who knows what kind of potential is in that genome in terms of its adaptive capacity and what we might learn from it in the future.
Well, I tell you, I got to get down there because the idea of seeing sturgeon and cypress trees in the same waters is kind of incongruous to me. I'm sure it's normal for you guys, but I'm excited. I got to get down. Is there any spot on the Suwannee River where I could go and view these guys jumping?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a couple good boat landings where you could just post up and watch them jump in the early morning hours.
Okay. Are these secret? Do we
want to? No. Yeah. Fanning Springs is one area and Manatee Springs, but I would focus on Fanning Springs, which is right off the highway there. There's a state park there.
I think we could talk for another couple hours. Well, thank you both so much. This was amazing talking to you. I really appreciate it. And y'all have so much knowledge. Super cool.
Yeah. Thank you.
Really loved it.
We'll get out there and live with, live from, discover, and enjoy all the fish, especially the Gulf sturgeon. Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. My name is Katrina Liebeck, and my co-host is Guy Arrow. Fish of the Week is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Region Office of Communications. Our production partner for the series is Citizen Race Car. We honor, thank, and celebrate the whole community, individual tribes, states, our sister agencies, fish enthusiasts, scientists, and others who have elevated our understanding and love as people and professionals of all the fish.
This is Statewide News from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. Anchorage police shot and killed a man who allegedly held people hostage Friday morning in a room at a Midtown hotel. It's the second fatal shooting by officers this year. Police Chief Sean Kay says officers responded at around 3:50 a.m. Friday. Security from the hotel reported a suspicious vehicle that they believed was stolen, Case says, and one of the two people who left the vehicle went into a hotel room. A SWAT team responded to the call, and Case says a separate negotiation team was able to make contact with the suspect.
While that communication was taking place, two rounds were fired through the door, presumably at the officers as they were on the outside of the room.
Kay says officers didn't immediately go into the room after shots were fired. In total, he says there were six people in the room, including the suspect. Some of them were children. Earlier this month, police shot and killed a man after they say he pointed a gun at vehicles driving along a busy Midtown road. In total, Anchorage officers have shot four people this year. Last year, Anchorage police shot eight people. Five of them died. The Iditarod Trail Committee announced last week that the race restart will shift north this year, with the route beginning in Fairbanks instead of Willow due to a lack of snow on a portion of the southern route. But the precise location for that restart remained unclear until last Thursday, that is. KUAC's Patrick Gilchrist reports.
For us, the carnival is coming to town.
That's Jay Ramris, owner of Pike's Waterfront Lodge. The Iditarod restart has moved up to Fairbanks three previous times in race history, in 2003, 2015, and 2017. And each of those 3 years, Pike's property on the Chena River has been the spot for mushers to begin their Iditarod journey. This year will be the fourth. And Ramris says he quipped about that number's significance with mushing legend Dave Munson and T-Dog 200 organizer Tekla Butcher Munson. She's the daughter of Munson and four-time Iditarod champion Susan Butcher, who died of leukemia in 2006.
And I told them that in the world of hospitality, since this was our fourth time hosting the Iditarod, that would be considered a championship host of the Iditarod. So I've now tied Susan Butcher's record of a four-time Iditarod champ, and we all had a good laugh over that over coffee.
The ceremonial start event will still take place in Anchorage on March 1st at 10 a.m. The 33 teams will then pack up and head north for the restart at Pikes, which is set for March 3rd at 11 a.m. In Fairbanks, I'm Patrick Gilchrist.
This is Alaska Public Media.
The Alaska Morning News is brought to you in part by
North Rim Bank, helping power the businesses that power Alaska with customized solutions. More at northrim.com.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This is statewide news from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. Lawmakers heard last week that they're facing even larger deficits than they previously thought. As Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports, that's complicating a key priority for major caucus lawmakers in the House and Senate, boosting funding for public schools.
After one hearing and with little discussion, the House Finance Committee has put a high-priority bill that would substantially boost state education funding on the brink of reaching the floor for a final vote. But it's also facing stiff opposition from minority caucus Republicans.
I can tell you right now, I don't see any way that the legislature under our current fiscal regime has any way to meet these obligations if this bill were to pass.
That's Fairbanks Republican Representative Will Stapp questioning the sponsor of the House's top education funding bill, Sitka Independent Representative Rebecca Himshute. The bill would boost education spending by more than $325 million next year, with additional increases the following 2 years. A few days earlier, lawmakers heard some grim projections about the state's finances. Between the current year's budget and next year's, legislators are short more than $530 million to maintain what is essentially the status quo. Senate leaders say dipping into the state's main savings account isn't on the table. Senate Finance Committee co-chair Senator Lyman Hoffman, a Bethel Democrat, says it would be irresponsible to spend the savings account on what are typical operating expenses. And Hoffman says that leaves lawmakers with few options.
If we're going to meet our obligations, we need to, I believe, address new revenues.
Major revenue measures, though, have been few and far between. The only bill to get serious consideration so far comes from an unexpected source, a conservative minority caucus Republican senator. Wasilla Senator Robert Yount filed a bill that would expand the state's corporate income tax to cover so-called S corporations. The bill is widely expected to apply to just one taxpayer, Hillcorp. Yount says it's all about leveling the playing field. So-called C corporations like ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips pay state income taxes, but S corps don't.
It's real money. I'm here to count pennies, nickels, right? Dimes, quarters, and dollars. And, you know, an average family of four in Alaska right now, this one loophole is over $700 a year.
For the state, it would raise $185 million in its first year and $125 million the next. Members of the largely Democratic bipartisan Senate majority welcome the proposal, but it's unclear whether it has support in the House. That led Stapp, a minority caucus lawmaker, to do the legislative equivalent of throwing his hands up in frustration.
I'm interested to hear what the majority's proposals are to be able to fund the bill, but I will absolutely bite. I know this is a big priority for you guys, so Mr. Co-Chair, with the permission of the committee, I'm going to go ahead and see if I can move the bill.
And he did. At its first hearing, the bill passed out of the Finance Committee with no opposition. That leaves it on the brink of a final House floor vote. But when it might come up for a final vote, if ever, is an open question. Shortly before the bill moved from the Finance Committee, Governor Mike Dunleavy said the standalone funding bill, quote, does not have my support. Representative Andy Josephson, an Anchorage Democrat who co-chairs the House Finance Committee, says for now, the majority is holding out hope that lawmakers and the governor can come to an agreement.
Cynics might say, yeah, but they won't bear fruit. But we're told that they may very well bear fruit. And we want to get, as I noted in Finance Committee, to a win-win with the administration.
But even if a compromise is reached, it'll still take money to pay for it. And back at the Senate Finance Committee, lawmakers are steeling themselves for some tough choices. Here are Senators James Kaufman, Lyman Hoffman, and Jesse Keel.
I think we need to add scissors to this tray of equipment on our desk.
Red pens, maybe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel.
Or Zoloft.
They've got a little less than 3 months to figure it out. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
This is Alaska Public Media.
Think of your fellow man, lend him a helping hand, put a little love in your heart. You see, it's getting late. Oh, please don't hesitate. Put a little love in your heart, and the world will be a better place. And the world will be a better place for you and me. Here, just wait and see. Another day goes by, still the children cry. Put a little love in your heart. If you want the world to know, we won't let hate grow.
Yeah, good morning, everybody out here in Southwest Alaska. Looks like I wasn't around Thursday and Friday. I wasn't feeling that well on Thursday, and Friday was my birthday. And thanks for all the calls, even though I wasn't here. It's, you know, I was turned 75. It's like, boy, that's 75 years. It's huge. I should have been running around with my friends, hitting the bars like the old days. Oh, yeah. What did I do? Stay by myself at home most of the time. Why? Because it's paradise here. I start out here with some Waylon Jennings with the Woolard Surprise. After that, Johnny Horton with She Knows Why, and then Willie Nelson with Can I Sleep in Your Arms?
I'm not here to forget you. I'm here to recall the things we used to say and do. I don't want to get over you. I don't want to get over you. I haunt the same places we used to go, alone at a table for two. I don't want to get over you. I don't want to get over you. They ought to give me the word of surprise. All the silver I let slide down the slot. Song, song blue. Help me remember you. I don't want to get over you. A fresh roll of quarters, same old song. Missing you through and through. I don't want to get over you. I don't want to get over you. They ought to give me the word of surprise for all the silver I let slide down the slot. Playing those songs so blue. Help me remember you. 'Cause I don't want to get over you. I don't want to get over.
I have a story I'd like to tell. Broken hearts know it only too well. And she knows why I feel the way I do. She gave me all her loving and she took it away. Skies they turn to a solid gray. Now she knows why I feel the way I do. Well, I know I'm a walking down a lovesick trail. It's been walked by many before. But when she sees my set of tracks, she'll know I've learned the score. I'll take my tears, put them on the shelf, and keep my heartaches to myself. 'Cause she knows why I feel the way I do. She took it away. The blue skies, they turned to a solid gray. Now she knows why I feel the way I do. Well, I know I'm a-walking down a lovesick trail. It's been walked by many before. But when she sees my set of tracks, she'll know I've learned the score. I'll take my tears, put them on the shelf, and keep my heartaches to myself. 'Cause she knows why I feel the way I do.
Can I sleep
asleep in your arms tonight, lady. It's so cold lying here all alone, and I have no hope to hold on you. And I assure you I'll do you no wrong. Don't know why, but the one I love left me. Left me lonely and cold and so weak. And I need someone's arms to hold me till I'm strong enough to get back on my feet. Can I sleep in your arms tonight, lady? It's so cold lying here all alone, and I have no hope to hold on you. And I assure you I'll do you no wrong. I sleep in your arms tonight, lady. It's so cold lying here all alone, and I have no hope to hold on you. I'll do you no wrong.
Hallelujah.